proud to have Troy here. Most of you know that Troy is very involved in undergraduate research with our students. And so we're pleased to have you. He was a recipient of last year's grant, so this is his culmination of his project. So, Dr. Ledeen, our format has been teach and give us your research or what you've been working on, and then allow us some time for questions, if we're smart enough to have questions.
Talking about changing the perception of scientific findings, or that scientific findings should not be accepted through an understanding of biblical directives toward environmental stewardship. One of the things that we have here are non-majors. There is a big dislike of science, putting it mildly, I think. Some of them hate science. They wait till their last semester to take their science elective, or not elective, gen ed course, and they don't want to be in there. And one of the things I try to do in environmental issues, this class I'm doing, this is Environmental Issues Biology 2406, is to introduce biblical directives. And in the past, I've used basically only Genesis 1:28, the Dominion verse. But this semester, I did start incorporating a lot more. We had fun with some of them, and we'll go through here in a little bit, and I'll show you some of them of what I did. One of them that we had a lot of fun with. But when we started this last June, Sherilyn asked, if anything really scared us about the a grant that we received in presenting this stuff in the class. And of course, I joked with her, telling, I teach evolution to creationists, and I teach climate change to Republicans. Nothing can scare me. But on a serious note, I'm using the Word of God. And with that backing me up, nothing better scares me. And that's kind of the way I look at this. So let's go ahead and start. And so what I do, I use this as a true issues class. I don't put any order of topics down in the class on the syllabus. We cover topics as they pop up in the news. There are select topics that we do cover, and I'm going to go through some of these as we go through. But just some examples, impact things occurring locally. 2 years ago, the forest fires north of town. I started out the class with that and incorporated that right into the class. But I use the Marshall News Messenger, Longview paper. They're not that good as far as bringing a lot of science in, but the Dallas Morning News, New York Times, Los Angeles Times, the Austin Statesman, BBC News, Texas Tribune, you can see up here. This is just a couple topics, a couple headlines that were in the papers Sunday and yesterday. And that's what I would do. If I see that, if it's something that's pertinent to the class, I incorporate it. We start talking about it. I'll put the link to the article on Blackboard. It's a toolbox previously put on Blackboard, and give the students a chance to read it, and then we'll talk about it. Sometimes it's 5 minutes before class, and they'll get a chance to read it. But I still give them the background. All right. So what, some of the things that we talk about, the state of the environment. As far as pollutants, endocrine disruptors, herbicides, fertilizers, we've talked about all this. What do they do to the environment? What are endocrine disruptors? Have to go through a little bit of the endocrine system to explain this to students, but that's not a problem. And then we go from there, talk about this, talk about what we're doing to the environment, and I'll get back to some of the verses that we're using for that. Just want to finish this up with, have you had your daily total of endocrine disruptors yet? In serious note, this is one of the greatest concentrations of endocrine disruptors that you can eat, that you can consume. Both of these, plastic bottles and meats.
Go back to that. I'm not supposed to ask questions.
That's fine.
But talk to us about estrogen mimickers.
Endocrine disruptors?
Yeah.
The endocrine system. And it's the primary endocrine disruptor that's of concern are the ones dealing with estrogens. There's a number of endocrine hormones that are estrogens. One biggest one of concern is testosterone, which is a derivative of one of the estrogens. And the disruptors basically will stop the pathway of producing testosterone and cause the feminization of the male.
Wow.
At the least. Lou Gillette at the University of Florida is doing a lot of research on alligators in Florida, trying to figure out why populations are declining. And one of the first things he found was in some population studies was where are the males? And they found that the lakes, a lot of the lakes that they were doing the studies on had so many endocrine disruptors in there that they were disrupting the process of actually making the testosterone, and they were not getting males in the population. And if there are no males in the population, obviously the population's not going to do very well.
Yeah.
So that's the thing with endocrine disruptors. Bringing that in. One of the things I bring in with that is one of the areas in the United States that we're pumping a lot of endocrine disruptors into the chemicals into the atmosphere is the San Francisco area. We have a lot of we have a lot of fun with that one in class. But seriously, it is. There are a lot. The highest concentration of endocrine disruptors pumped into the atmosphere is from the industry around San Francisco. And I know it does explain a lot, and we have a lot of fun with that in the class. Right. So
people who want to be disrupted that move to San Francisco.
Yeah. Yeah. For some of us, it might be a little bit too late. But again, then you go back to epigenetics and. If it may show up in our kids, grandkids and their kids. So, a lot of problems coming up in theirs. Obviously, with environmental issues, climate change is a big one. Sea level rise. I just put this map up there. One of the things we talk about. Sea level rise showing the potential at 6 meters. That's how much of the U.S. coast, southeast and east coast, would be flooded permanently with a 6 meter rise. The 1 meter rise is predicted by 2050, without question. That's going to happen. 6 meters potential by 2100 is very real. And I just saw an article today that they're talking in the neighborhood of 20 meters by 2200. That's business. That's with business as usual. We still have a chance to change the last two numbers. The other thing to talk about, obviously, some economics as well. And the one that really catches the students' attention is the adaptation cost. That's how much it would cost each year. This was actually $1,995. So I'm not sure what the dollars are now, even though the paper was put out in 2010. But $1,995 each year, this is what it would cost to protect, refurbish from sea level rises of 2 meters. And 2 meters are expected to happen without any question now. We have basically no choice. So, we think Congress thinks they have budget issues now. In about 20 years, they're really going to have budget issues. So, this is global. This $270 billion is globally, but the developed countries are going to take the brunt of it. The third world countries just going to have to basically move if they can. Climate change, changing water cycles, temperature changes. David just showed me a cartoon, Batman and Robin cartoon, Robin's telling Batman, yes, snow in April is due to global warming, and Batman's telling him he's an idiot. But it is. If you look at the Arctic jet, basically, what's happening is the melting of the ice cap and the warming of the Arctic Ocean is causing this to make bigger loops. And when it makes that big loop down, you get the cold weather. It's also causing the subtropical jet to move north. And models show the subtropical jet by 2025 to be right around the Oklahoma-Kansas border. So it's right now slightly south of us, which brings us our moisture when it moves up there. We're going to East Texas will be like West Texas as far as climate. Major things as far as, and we do discuss all this and so on, we go through. And point out, we have to discuss this because there are a few majors in here in the class every once in a while that are secondary education and life science, and this is some of their certification questions. So we have to cover some of this stuff. Obviously, biodiversity, polar bears asking where the next ice flow is so they can get to land, but that's the poster child for loss of species diversity, mass extinction, habitat loss, and so on. Put the question mark by mass extinction because it depends on who you talk about as to whether or not we're in a mass extinction event. If you talk to biologists, yes, we are. talk to geologists, paleontologists, wearing clothes. And you'll see later some of the questions I ask. Students, I bring up those concerns, and the students still have the still don't have a clue as far as what's going on, which is fine, because we don't have a clue as far as what's going on. Population growth, this is a big one. You see the numbers there, you know, 300,000 years to reach the first billion. Fifth, sixth, and seventh billion added in the last 15 years. And, you know, the cartoon sums it up. I don't know if you can read that or not, but it says, let me get this straight. It's our herd that needs to be thinned, referring to the deer, the deer in the park. But yeah, in the UN projections, using current fertility rates, by 2100, 21.8 billion people. That's a scary number. And the reason it's scary, I don't really have anything on this about it, but the concept of carrying capacity. We simply don't have the resources to handle that many people. Nobody knows how many people our resources can handle. Some ecologists, population ecologists, say we've already exceeded that level, which brings up really scary things. And we'll talk about this. What happens after you've exceeded that level? What happens in populations when you're getting close to that level? Water requirements. The map on the right, it's put out in 2006, thing to point out here is Texas. Economic water scarcity. In other words, people are not going to be able to afford water. The drought of 2 years ago brought that up very heavily. Last numbers I saw that if this drought were to continue for another 3 or 4 years, which it's expected to, potentially it could cost the state in the neighborhood of $250 billion. Texas can't afford it. and so and this is one thing that actually is coming good out of Austin. It's actually bringing some good stuff out of Austin. People are, our legislatures are starting to take water seriously. They're looking at actually limiting water use for fracking. Which number of reasons there. Let's go back to the endocrine disruptors. We don't know how many those are in fracking fluid, along with your tap water lining up when you turn on the tap. So, you know, it comes up with a number of things, but it uses a lot of water. It uses more water than irrigating a field to frack a well, which is a very considerable amount. And the other slide simply shows some of the changes in water use. And a lot of these changes in water use, this is basically where jet streams are going to start being more, it's projected to be more drop on water. This is the part of the country I grew up in right here in the southern, southwestern part of the panhandle of Nebraska. On the Ogallala Aquifer, of course, you know, south of Nebraska, that part of Nebraska getting large quantities of water. There's enough water in that part of Nebraska to run for another 100,000 years. At current water use. They don't really need it there. Before it's needed. Yeah, in area, and also, of course, California is starting to use desalinization, which is expensive. It goes back to, doesn't show up here, but it's going to be a lot more expensive too for people in California as far as water. Food requirements, this one, food index, basically how much food is costing based on baseline of 2005-2006. And we all know going to the grocery store the last couple of years how much food's gone up. And so from there, what's going on, what's causing that? Availability, this simply shows availability. And this shows percentage change population, you know, where food's least available, where population's going to grow the most, unfortunately. All right, so the objectives of this study, again, they want to give the students appreciation of God's creation, and hopefully then science in general as well. Also, show them that God's Word does contain direction for environmental concerns. Most of them, actually, I found out, most of them actually were aware of this one. How well they applied it's another question, but they were aware of it. And then last, explain what we're doing to that creation through our actions, how much we are really messing it up. How I assessed this, I actually gave two surveys. Both, and the surveys were approved by the Human Resources Subjects Committee. I'm not sure what the name of it is anyway. But one at the beginning of the semester, one at the end of the semester. So I pre-test, pre-survey at the end of the semester, see how well I presented things, how well the students picked things up, and their understanding. We'll talk some signed rank tests. This is a non-parametric parity test, if you don't know your statistics. And I used R for analyzing all statistics, mainly because it's a free program. And in some ways, a lot easier to use than some of the others. And then on the final exam, I asked how well we are following the directive given to man in Genesis 1:26, 1:28 stewardship. That was the only, and usually on the exams, I give the students three or four questions, I'm sorry, and they get to pick one question to answer. They're opinion papers, and so they can give their opinion, and they are told that, you know, opinions are worthless unless you can back them up. So they have to defend their opinions. There is a they get a rubric on how I grade it. They have to have the science backing up their opinion most of the time. There's one question that there's an exception to, and I'll get to that in a little bit. And based on this, how well was this occurring? I've asked this question over the last few years, and I see some real interesting answers. We're doing a great job. You know, population growth is not a problem. I'm not sure where, and this is at the end of the class after I presented all this other stuff. So I'm not sure what they were thinking, where they were during the class when I was talking. A little bit of the demographics of the class, this is basically just show what the makeup is. All law majors this last semester, most of them business, psychology. Political party affiliation, I asked that simply because a number of polls show that Republicans have a tendency to not accept climate change. Period. It's not happening, period. Especially human-caused climate change. And most of our students are Republicans, which that, again, that didn't surprise me. The importance of church at the beginning and the end. I wanted to find out, one thing I want, definitely didn't put this into the objectives, but I do not want to change their ideology. I want to change their attitudes, but not their ideology. In other words, if they're a Republican coming in, I don't care. I definitely want them going to church. I want church to be important. You know, I don't want them to think that. And it's actually, I didn't put down the statistics on here, but actually showed the number. It was a statistical difference showing the church is more important at the end of the semester than the beginning of the semester. I really don't think what I did in the semester had any bearing on that. I think it was more some of them dropping out. The ones that withdrew from the class were the ones that tended to not consider it important. And finally,
it could be just they spent a semester on our campus.
It could be too. It could be that too.
It's the chapel. Where's the chapel?
That's right.
Yeah.
See, I was actually thinking that your class was so hard that they knew at the end they needed grace.
this is the easiest class I teach. No, second easiest class I teach. The easiest one I teach is in May. This is actually, again, it's opinion paper, but you'd be surprised how many of our students cannot form an opinion.
Yeah.
Backing it up, I understand, but they cannot form an opinion, which is really surprising. And this is not just freshmen. It's some of our seniors that can't form an opinion. And then also, they previously heard in sermons on environmental topics. I just was curious about this, and actually it was a lot higher than I was expecting. Of course, I'm not sure that's pretty typical what's going on with some students. You know, they're not sure even in class when I hear stuff. So how did I integrate everything? Obviously, we talked about dominion. What does it mean to have dominion? That was the first question I threw out there. And I got 40 total blank stares when I gave that question. So we stepped through what dominion meant and went through stewardship. And we had some good discussion about that. And then we got into how well we're doing. Before I talked about anything, how well we were doing. And you know, most of them thought we were doing fairly well. And you can see, you know, the state needs to care for the environment. They all agreed with that. At the end, it was even higher. And this was actually was a statistical significance as far as the difference. That it does mean so. Hopefully, what I said did got through to them that, you know, we are to care for the environment. Dominion does not mean domination. And then God tells us directly how we're to interact with the environment. Yeah, that's one, you know, they already figured that. They knew that coming in, it didn't really change anything. And so they knew it coming in, I didn't figure it would really change that much. All right. Limitations to population growth. Again, for the fruitful and multiply part in Genesis 1:28, also Genesis 9:1, after Noah. And we're going to get to that one again a little bit here. But how does dominion fit with be fruitful and multiply? I didn't ask any specific questions about this, but other than class discussion. We just got some good lively class discussion on this, and a lot of differing opinions. Nothing really, no opinion really stood out to either one. We'll go to the environmental degradation, pollution, consumption of food and water, lumped all together. A couple verses, Ezekiel 34:18, Numbers 35:34. Not for you to feed on good pasture, and thou shalt not defile the land. Brought those in, and the question I asked was, humans cannot destroy the environment beyond use because only God can destroy and create the earth. I totally agree with it. I definitely disagree with this statement, and most of the students disagree with this statement. There is still, about a third of them that say, we're not going to be able to destroy the environment. Even after everything that we talk about, we have capabilities of destroying the environment several times over. If we can take and change our course of a river in eastern Kentucky and move it from the east side of the mountain to the west side of the mountain so it doesn't flood the town, we have capabilities of really doing damage. We're pumping more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere than the atmosphere knows what to do with. So, it's somewhat surprising that their opinions really didn't change, and you can see from the statistics, the probability as far as the differences, they really did not change anything. We had a lot of fun with this one. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you, Genesis 9:3. Talk about energy flow through systems, second law of thermodynamics. Basically, just a little background for those of you who may not be familiar with that. As we consume the food, there's less energy available for us to use as it goes from plant to animal. So that cow, even though it has more energy, it's actually less energy than what's available if we eat the plants that the cow consumed. So I asked the question on
that again. One more time.
That's about the way the students get it, too.
One more time. I was getting it, y'all, for the last
basically, there's an energy pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
At the base of the pyramid, there's more energy available there.
Right.
That's coming in from sunlight. As you go up that, the second law of thermodynamics describes what happens to energy. Some of it transfers up, some of it transfers out of the system.
Right.
And what goes out of the system is totally unusable to everything that's left in the system.
Okay.
So the cow eats the grass and gets the energy. It takes a lot of that energy to convert a pound of grass it takes 60 pounds of grass to convert one, to make 1 pound of cow. And so that 1 pound of cow then is able to make half an ounce of us.
Okay.
And the rest of it totally lost to the system.
Okay.
So I asked just to see what kind of discussion we would get. And we had real good discussion in class from three or four students. And so I thought I'd throw it out. And actually a couple more students actually did attempt to answer this question. Why would God give us the right to eat meat, knowing that energy flow decreases through trophic levels? That's trophic levels, that's the description of grass to cow to us and so on. This is one question that if they can cut science in there, great. If not, I didn't care. Because there really is no good answer to this one, except for one answer that I did get from a student. That's just one question I'm going to ask God when I meet. Because it makes no sense whatsoever. But we did have a lot of fun with that question. All right, so believing now, this is some other questions then. We'll talk about them, we'll go through. Large amount of historical laboratory data supporting global warming. Got my numbers backwards here. I thought I had a degree with a neutral list. That there was a significant change. They actually do recognize that we do have some scientific data backing up global warming and climate change in general. Going in, a large number of them weren't sure. The neutral part simply not sure. And this was all done on a Likert scale, by the way. From strongly disagree to strongly agree, and I did lump the strongly disagree and disagree together, same with the agree, for all statistical analyses. So there was a pretty good change on there, so at least I've gotten to understand, the little bit about science that we did have the understanding of data supporting global warming. And I'll put this last on here. You can see the numbers as far as how people agree. I just want to compare that to our class. Americans in general, about 70%. Conservatives, only 30% think that there's global warming is actually occurring. This is actually, the numbers at the bottom are actually is global warming occurring. And evangelical Christians, about 60%, but it's a human cause, only about a third of evangelical Christians say that it's a human cause. And, you know, the makeup of the class is about 69% conservatives. And you see, they actually differ a little bit as far as human cause and our laboratory data and so on from the public in general. Right. Second exam on the previous slide, should economic recovery be placed ahead of environmental concerns? Asked this again this semester on the survey, asked it also on the exam, one of the exams. Prior to this year, all responses say the environment takes second place to economic recovery. In other words, fix my pocketbook before I fix the environment. Not realizing if you fix your pocketbook and you don't have any place to live in the environment, it doesn't mean you get to have a fixed pocketbook. from the current class, this is about midterm when this question is asked. Current class, there were still more students midterm stated that economic recovery was more important than environmental concerns. Once, if we ever get economic recovery, it would be interesting to see what that question is like then. The current class, economic concerns less important than the economic, or environmental concerns less important than the economic concerns. At the beginning, you can see that 4%, only 4% agreed, and about 70% agreed. So a very significant change in attitudes from that. Personal rights are more important than protecting the environment. No change whatsoever, really, from this throughout the semester. In other words, you know, let's protect it, but I'm not giving up I'm not giving up anything. I'm not going to give up my steak on Friday nights. I'm going to drive from the dorm to the classroom. So it appears that attitudes changed, but I really don't think the behavior's changed. Some of this comes in with psychology. I know that it's extremely difficult to change somebody's behavior. But again, it's interesting to see that. All right, so far more as far as understanding the science happened here. One on the bottom, I don't know why I got that one on the top on there twice. Global warming cannot be scientifically tested. Again, this goes back to is it actually occurring and so on. And I did get a little bit of a change there, not much. You can see from the p-value there was no change. From the probability values and statistics, there was absolutely no change. A lot of that comes with, you get one semester to present a lot of science. And that science, I understand, and I know, can be extremely confusing when you're skimming over the surface and you can't really get into it very deep. And so I think that's where a lot of that confusion still comes from. Right, I'm going to put the next one up here as well. Increasing price of fossil fuels due to economic reasons or due to decreasing supply. At the beginning, a large number of them thought it was. A large number of them didn't know, which is great. That did change. The don't knows didn't really change that much. But the number that agreed really did change. The disagrees didn't change that much. But those that weren't sure actually realized that it potentially could be due to decreasing supply. We discussed this. I also in the lab show a video clip that talks about this, talked about both sides of the story in this in pretty good detail. So they get a little bit more of this, a little more detail with this one. Mass extinctions. Species lost by humans, not important. Organism recovered from previous mass extinction events. No change in that one. And like I mentioned earlier, you know, science doesn't know if we're even in a mass extinction event. So if we don't know if we're in a mass extinction event, this question's moot. Makes no difference. And so I would expect to see very little change from the students' attitudes. And mentioned, you know, the disagreement. Biologists say biologists are looking at rare species and seeing rare species disappear. Paleontologists when they look at the fossil record, the species they see disappearing in mass extinction events are the more common species. In other words, they're seeing the cockroach, the black rat disappear. We're seeing the dodo and, you know, the Kirkland's warbler disappear. Kirkland's warbler, there are still about 50 of them in existence. We're seeing those disappear right now as far as biology, but paleontologists actually see the ones that are very common disappear. And so there's disagreement in that way as far as science, as far as whether or not we're even in a mass extinction event. All right, where to from here? One of the things I'm going to do next year in relation to resource use and the desire for more than we need. I'm going to talk, use the Lord's Prayer, give us our daily bread, talk about the daily manna given to the Israelites in their exodus from Egypt. And why do we desire more than what we need each day, other than my paycheck? But why do we desire that? One of the biggest businesses in the United States right now is the building of storage buildings. Mm-hmm. People don't have enough room in our huge houses, so we rent storage buildings and stick it in the storage building, never to see it again. So we pay rent on that storage building. Now, we don't need it. We don't need as much. In the United States, we definitely don't need as much as what we do. And in relation to resource use, we're running out of resources. We're going to have to do some limitations coming up. And I think this is an excellent way to start. So conclusion, to me, what science does is integrates God's word with what we see in the world. And those of you who are not physicists out here, this is, God said, all this equation, and there was light. These are the equations explaining how we get light. The Maxwell-Lorentz equations in physics explain how light is actually produced. So from there, science, really, one of the goals of physics is a unified theory of everything. To me, great, unified theory of everything. But a unified theory of everything is God's work plus his work. All right, that's great. This is probably an easier way. Okay.
So, when students start this class, you're basically saying that in most cases, they don't accept scientific findings.
Most of them do not.
Because most of them think they can point to the Bible and say this is what matters, not
large number of them do, yes. Large number of them. And I've had it said to me several times, point out something, science, it doesn't matter what I'm talking about. My Bible does not say that. And it's like, fine, show me where you think it said this, and then we'll start talking about it. But I get that a lot. And there's a very big disdain for science on this campus by our non-majors. Some of our majors hate it, but that's just simply because of the exams that we give.
Did you have, I know you're going to incorporate, you pointed out you're going to incorporate a New Testament scripture next time. Mm-hmm. All the scriptures you used were Old Testament scriptures?
The ones I put up here, yeah, were.
Right.
I can't remember the New Testament ones I used.
Did that ever come in as an argument if you were trying to...
You know, I never got any arguments when I brought up a scripture that pointed, that supported what we were talking about. I never got any arguments about that. I got the what are you talking about when I brought up Genesis 9:3. After we had gone through the trophic energy flow and trophic systems, after we'd gone through that, I got that, what are you talking about? And explained that a little more. And then, like I said, we spent 2.5 class periods talking about this. This is a Tuesday, Thursday class. So
I would contend that their perceptions do not come from somebody teaching them that the scriptures say differently. They come from people who talk about the subject void of scripture and say,
I think so.
This is not happening. Yeah. This is not God's plan. Mm-hmm. It's not
a tit-for-tat type conversation that they're coming into your classroom from. They've just been taught from the pulpit or taught from Christian media or taught from different things that that whole thing is equated to Al Gore, you know, who's a leftist communist. And so, I mean, you know, I'm saying that's what they come in with, the perception.
I agree with that. I agree with that. And one of the things that I wish would happen, I wish Richard Dawkins would shut his mouth. Because from the atheist side, they're presenting ideologies. I wish Richard Dawkins would shut his mouth from the atheist side. I wish Ken Ham would shut his mouth from the Christian side. Neither one of them are presenting true science. Dawkins' evolution, by the way, is not 100% accurate. But both of them are doing more harm. People need to be looking at Francis Collins, looking at his works, and Ken Miller's works. Of course, if you read Ken Miller's works, you better start with a very, very open mind, because he will make you very mad while you're reading his book. Francis Collins a little more, he's easier to read.
What I've seen is, it looks like also, the sermons that we hear don't get into anything besides common things.
Yeah,
some common biblical things are not into this direction. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so they don't see science that kind of controversy there, or just where is it in the Bible? I don't know. And some of it back to the New Testament, Old Testament kind of thing too. Some of these directives are in what God was saying back then, so they kind of say, oh, we don't worry about that.
And I have seen that. I have seen that.
Well, that's why I was wondering.
One of the things that I've seen on that one question that I asked, I didn't think about this until just now. I didn't see it this year, but I've seen it in the past, is that we don't have to follow the directives of the Old Testament since the death of Christ. I've seen that on Answers. I'm not sure where that thinking came from. I mean, some of the laws of Leviticus, I understand. You might know. That's why I'm looking at Scott. He might know. Or Elijah might know. I have no idea where that comes from. I mean, some of the laws of Leviticus, yeah, I understand.
You know, that, Troy, but I also know that you play, and I know your heart, you also know the gravity of the subject of which you teach, and it's so important that you close the loop with a Christian worldview. And I know, and I appreciate that about you, because I know it's difficult, and I think about our psychology people who teach subjects that they have to close the loop on it and still talk about some pretty divisive subjects, things that students have not even been allowed to talk about in their home, much less. And I'm sure that the same is true in your science classroom.
Oh, yeah. One question I just throw out for discussion, basically for the shock value, is that I'm sure Scott will appreciate this. He's probably hasn't heard it yet, heard any backlash from it yet. Is when we talk about the endocrine disruptors and talk about how many there are in the San Francisco area, just for the shock value, I throw out, if we are doing this to somebody, disrupting their endocrine systems in this way, is homosexuality a sin? And some of the students, after they get up off the floor from falling out of their chair, actually have some pretty good discussion about that. But, and I tried to get them to think, is basically what I want them to do. Like, in some cases, way outside the box. And if they come anywhere near to closing the box, great. If not, with some of those questions, like that one, you know, it's some general one that I just throw out, hoping that I don't get in too much trouble when I throw it out there.
Troy, sorry I came in a little bit.
That's fine.
I missed some of this, but it seems that endocrine disruption affects not just specific populations, but everybody, potentially. And so,
it does.
Is that not a resource for understanding the value of the environment on the very makeup of our society?
It should be, but you know that I see very little in the news about endocrine disruption. Maybe one or two articles a year. And that's usually buried way deep in the front page section where nobody or very few people read. That's where most of the science is. That's why I'm back there anyway. It gets buried. And yeah, it's extremely important to everyone. And you know, we don't have much time to go into it, but epigenetics, basically our DNA can be modified by some of these chemicals. And not only does it affect us, but in rats it's been shown to affect at least six generations later. So that's great, 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 great grandkids. So yeah, major implications for
another
us.
Another question I had, and of course follow up on that one too, but is there a case for a serious attempt in our ranks to teach people in such a way that they cannot avoid the fact of Christianity historically sponsoring the advent of modern science?
I bring that in. You know, I bring that in that Newton was a Christian. You know, he also refused to uphold part of his post. I don't remember what the post is that he held at Oxford, Cambridge, one of the two. I don't remember which one it was. But he was part of what he was supposed to do. Stephen Hawking just left that post. He was supposed to be part of the pastoral staff, and he refused to do that. He was one of the first to refuse to do that. But yeah, I bring that in that a large number of the original Enlightenment figures, or figures of the Enlightenment, that brought science to the forefront were definitely Christians. I think part of the problem is Richard Dawkins, Ken Ham, I'm just using both of those as examples, have polarized the issue so much that Christians think that all scientists are atheists. A large number of scientists think that Christians are idiots. And you're not going to merge the two, because Francis Collins, Ken Miller are very quiet. And so I think that's a lot of the problem. That's why I said I wish the two of them would just shut up. It would make our job a lot easier.
I would say the big picture, the church has come around pretty quickly, considering, you talk about the 100 years from the Stokes trial to now, that there's a pretty good evangelical push to even consider climate issues.
Oh yeah, I agree.
So, you know, big picture, considering also the church, you know, went after scientists who published things that were contrary to the literal interpretation of Scripture for hundreds and hundreds of years. It is, from a trajectory standpoint, a pretty significant shift in a short amount of time that evangelicals are even talking about.
Oh yeah, I agree.
So there's a little positive.
There's some positive. On the climate change part, there is some positive.
Yes. Well, the other piece of that, though, there does seem to be, at least the younger generation of Christians, see this as a stewardship issue more so than even my generation and yours. So that. And that's something I think that can also be celebrated, that they're recognizing we have a role in this, and we're not just, you know, complete dominators left to just do what we want.
Right. And I think it's a little bigger than what you're actually letting on, because of the degree of urbanization that's occurred from our generation to this generation. Most of the students now grew up in cities. They have no idea where they're from.
Right.
I mean, even in my generation, my grandfather, this is in the middle of nowhere in a farming community. I grew up on a farm. At the grocery store, my grandfather overheard somebody saying, this is a town of 6,000 people, overheard a woman say that, I don't know why the farmers are so concerned about food crisis. I get my milk from the grocery store. And this was 60 years ago, 50 years ago.
So, yeah, because the degree of urbanization, I know that a large number of our students don't have a clue exactly what everything goes through our food to get our food at the table. I do talk about that, you know, bring up in farm resource use, and I bring that up in class. You know, ask them how many of the foods that they ate today actually originated in Texas. Unless they ate deer or turkey, none of it. So. No, yeah, it is. So I think it's a little bigger than what you think. At least for climate change.
Yeah.
There are other aspects of science, though, that are becoming even more polarized. And that's why I used Richard Dawkins and Ken Ham.
Other comments, questions? Troy, we appreciate you, and thank you very much. And he concludes our scholars forum for this year. So, great job.